Rules Committee resolution that was passed by the Rules Committee on a vote of 3-2 was condensed findings of our report. And our report was even stronger in language than what this resolution purports to convey to the public. I think that it's incumbent upon the other 15 members of this body to be able to stand up and to be able to go on record as to the proceedings that were open to them. They have full access to the floor. They debated very eloquently and very fluently with the members of the Rules Committee. We did not suppress any kind of evidence. We allowed them to cross-examine any of the testimony or any of the witnesses that came before the committee. We have, in the beginning of our process, taken the middle ground, clear and convincing evidence, which is a higher standard than a lower standard, really, than what the grand jury took. Grand jury took a beyond a reasonable doubt. We took a look at all of the testimony. And I think that, Mr. President, that if we take the guts out of the resolution, and the guts are basically that after a lengthy testimony, find substantial, and I think there was substantial, but less than clear and convincing evidence that William J. Sheffield has committed an impeachable offense. And I think that when we get down to talking about that, we're not only talking about him in person, but we're talking about those people that he has around him. Because the Constitution that we adopted back in 1956 was a Constitution that put grave responsibilities on the chief executive. In fact, our chief executive is probably the most powerful chief executive in the nation. And he carries with him not only great powers, but he also carries with him great responsibilities. And I think that after 2 weeks of very dedicated work by all of the members of the Senate, as transpired since we referred this serious consideration by the grand jury, the thoughts have come to my mind many times through the thousands of pages of testimony and paper and all of the things that we had, but just where was the meat of it? And I think that the meat of the whole thing was that the governor, in examination before the investigators, in examination before the grand jury, and in examination before the Senate Rules Committee, was not fully candid. In other words, I don't think that he came completely clean with the whole story. I think it was after prying, probing. I think that was true after we got into the meeting that was held on the 23rd of April of this year, that it was not a matter that he directly lied, and I don't believe that was ever proven that he directly lied. But I think that there was an awful lot of inference, and that's when we say that the testimony finds that there's substantial reason why we should look at this. And I think that when we give our thoughts to this, and I think that this is the central point of the whole special session, is this particular resolution. And this resolution resolves basically that we did not find the clear convincing evidence that this man had done those impeachable offenses according to the standards that we, the Senate, set for ourselves, or we, the Rules Committee, set for ourselves. But we have serious questions about the accuracy of the testimony under oath. And I think that that's proven. And I think that if you go back to the closing remarks of Mr. Dabb, Mr. Dabb, I want to remind the senators that there was some inference this morning brought up about it being a trial, a grand jury. The grand jury is a fact-finding group. The Senate Rules Committee set as a fact-finding group. But I refer to a kind of like we were in a boxing then, there was a court atmosphere up there in the Rules Committee, that Sam Dash, our counsel, was not a prosecutor, he was a fact-finding attorney, and he conducted himself as such. And if you asked him any questions, why, he would reiterate, Senator, I'm in a fact-finding process, I'm not in an adversary position. And I think that you would find that as the mold of the whole process went by, and I think that this is true with the viewing audience, I think that this is probably one of the finest days in the technical technology that we have today, with people in Copper Center, people in Kotzebue, people in Anchorage, Fairbanks, not only the major centers, but all over the state, went to see the tenure of what was going on from gavel to gavel. And I think that the president and the chairman of the committee have got to be certainly commended for that. But in Dash's comments, when he made his closing statements, he put it right square back on the members of the Senate. He didn't put it on the members of the Rules Committee, but he says, you as a collective body have got to make up your mind. And I thought of that at the time when he said that. What would have happened in 1955 if those 55 delegates had vacillated on what kind of a process should happen and whether we should take a hard decision on a hard line of whatever we had to do? If that would have been, if that would have been at that day and age, you certainly would not have had the model constitution that you have. But he says this committee also has some direct evidence, and this is on page 16, if you want to follow, not received by the grand jury, which I suggest could support the conclusion that the governor's testimony that he had never been made aware of the fact that Mr. Shively had told Mr. Stack to take RFP changes, it is not credible. You go down to the bottom of the line 17, I'm using the little tactics that the attorneys used on us, where you skip some of the testimony and you just kind of pick out those highlights, Mr. President, to kind of strengthen your case. Your conclusion as to whether the governor was truthful in his testimony before this committee will help you decide on the truthfulness of his testimony before the grand jury. Goes on, I suggest that the committee should consider the credibility of the governor's testimony to this committee that when the Fairbanks lease problems were first beginning to publicly explore, be publicly explored and investigated. One, he was not aware of the first Dan Jones exposed breaking of the story. Two, he did particularly nothing to inform himself of the facts when he learned of the Attorney General's investigation into his favorite project and building. Three, he does not remember being told by Lori Herman at the time when the role of his Office of Police Procurement were unraveling the sum and substance of the embarrassing DOA file of the Department of Administration file implicating Mr. Shively. And four, he was not or could not remember that he was fully briefed by the Attorney General Gorsuch and Chief Prosecutor Hickey on details and evidence to be presented to the grand jury of Mr. Shively's involvement in the RFP. He goes on, Mr. President, and he says, the committee can consider the following question in determining whether the governor's testimony before it and his statements in his press conference the next day are credible. Why did the governor not choose to give the explanation he made in his press conference and testimony to the governor, to the committee, and subject himself to questioning of the committee and the council? I think that this is where we come down to the point where we say accuracy. Because there again, he was not coming clean, or he was not telling the truth, or he might not have been lying, but he was not expanding upon the whole issue that we had before. Two, how can the governor schedule, noting a meeting with Mr. Gorsuch and Mr. Hickey, which the governor did remember in his testimony, give the governor any more information about the briefing meeting than which he had not already been, had already had when he testified before the committee. 3, regardless of whether the governor had been prepared for this particular question put to him, in light of the obvious impact that the dramatic events of the full day of April the 23rd on the governor, could the governor have been credible explanation for not candidly informing the committee that he had been fully briefed on the details of the evidence of Mr. Shively's involvement? I know that we're going to the heart of the whole process here, because if you accept the amendment, which is a watered-down, say-nothing, do-nothing type resolution that will come out of the Senate, I think that the Senate is ducking the issue and leaving the burden of proof upon the Rules Committee in the report. I have a letter that I received today, and I think it really, Mr. President, represents the thinking of my constituency, and it comes from Copper Senate. And it's addressed to me, and it says, "Dear Sir, although I voted for Sheffield in 82, I'm fairly disillusioned with the credibility of his testimony, of the testimony of the governor and his people. I consider the current impeachment proceedings a real test of whether or not the democratic process is alive and well in Alaska. To put it bluntly, I have absolutely no confidence in the integrity of the current administration. I am requesting that you consider my views when you make your own decision concerning this vital issue." I think that, Mr. President, that pretty much sums up exactly where we're at as far as the process is concerned, and I think that I do not want to carry on the process any longer, because I think that it's not only detracts to the credibility of Alaska, but I think that in closing I would like to say that after 25 years of a young state, I feel that this process has virtually taken the innocence away from this particular state.
President, thank you. My good and distinguished friend, colleague, and former Republican Party chairman, who loves to call himself Mr. Republican, he and I know each other because we've served in opposite parties. But he sounds to me like this lion sermonizing on the evils of meat. When he states that the assistant to the Senate was not in a prosecutorial fashion, of course, I was told if you quack like a duck and waddle like a duck, you're probably a duck all right. And I think that he was in a prosecutorial position. Now, I think we did not get into a political stance. I think we got into a very objective stance. In fact, I had communications from some of the members of the Rules Committee on about Wednesday night. And I thought, we're going to have a non-political decision, come what may, a resolution perhaps of impeachment to the floor, that's going to be decided by people without concern for partisan politics. And that still may be so. That may have happened. It may have happened. But on Wednesday night, we had a series of meetings, and the next night, and we had them with the prosecutor, and indeed, we brought the chief prosecutor before us, and we brought the attorney general before us. And that would have been fine, save for one thing. We didn't get, nor were we allowed to subpoena, nor were we allowed to bring the originally chosen barrister, lawyers, who had also looked at this case with great Alaska knowledge, great distinguish, and a great record of achievement in the law. Neither Ms. M.S. Burke nor former Attorney General Mr. Groth were subpoenaed or brought before us for their position and their ideas in this matter. So I don't think we had an equal time from Wednesday on. I think it became somewhat of a partisan exercise, or at least an in-house exercise within the Rules Committee that we are now. We really did not get a fairness from that date on to this in decision-making.
Senator Cullen.
Mr. President, let me point out that
most of the Republicans have been sitting here for 3 weeks getting this rag around from the public relations people on the third floor of the governor's office and from some Democrats that this is a partisan affair, this is a partisan affair. What's happening at this point, from my viewpoint, Mr. President, is that the public relations staff in the governor's office is trying to deny history, trying to deny that irregularities took place in the leasing of the Fairbanks office space, and they're trying to take this language out of the resolution. Further resolved that the Senate finds significant irregularities in the leasing process surrounding the Fifth Avenue Center in Fairbanks. What they're saying, Mr. President, is the fix is fine, and I'm not going to support that. I'm not going to support this amendment.
Senator Wright?
Mr. President, I was listening to my distinguished colleague here as he rambled on, and he was, at times he likes to lecture us about his association with the Constitutional Convention. And he brought up the point, and he tried to substantiate it with our good friend Mr. Dash's some of his recommendations, where I should say personal judgments. I think that's where it came down to, and a lot of us considered his remarks such as simply not credible. If not a recommendation, it was a personal judgment. And I think that that's all right, although he very carefully made a disclaimer and said that he was by no means prejudiced. And I think that he was kind of led into it a little bit by getting into a contest with Mr. Conway, Mr. Lockerberry, and it's perfectly natural, so I don't have any hard feelings toward Mr. Dash, even though his personal judgments were his own and should have been kept as his own. Now, as far as my good friend here from Copper Center, he's telling us that he thinks that we should all vote on his resolution because he thinks that that's the feeling of the Senate and we should be on record. Well, I think that what we're really doing here with the substitute is we're showing that the other 15 members or parts thereof have the opportunity to put forward what they believe should be voted on, and then the members of the Rules Committee can vote aye or nay on whether they think it's right or not. In other words, you got 15 other people that still have the same consideration or should have the same consideration as the five members of the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. President. A few things that have been said, I think I strongly disagree with them. One, characterized the original resolution as condemnation without chance of refutation. We've had extensive testimony. Very substantial rights have been provided to the governor's staff, counsel for cross-examination, for calling their own witness. Far beyond that, what had to be provided, and I commend Senator Kelly for running this committee in that fashion. The governor did have opportunity even to come back before the committee and testify as to his new recollections with regard to the events of this April. The governor, however, chose not to take that opportunity. Instead, went before the press and said that his recollection before the Senate had been inaccurate, and that he now had a new recollection of what happened with regard to those meetings, and he'd been confused about the meetings. I think that speaks for itself with regard to the inaccuracy of testimony. I think Senator Kelly has said that we want to say something about what's wrong and what happened in the Fairbanks lease matter. I think it is important, and I think Senator Cogdill pointed out very well that this has been a major event. I think it's been an opportunity for the people of Alaska to look inside of government. It's been a looking glass. But in that looking glass, it gives them an opportunity to see what we as politicians accept as standards of conduct and standards of truth. I think the resolution, as it's introduced, reflects the standards that I would like to portray. I think the resolution as amended, or proposed to be amended, reflects the standard of truth and conduct that I don't believe the public agrees with.
Senator Joseph.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, excuse me, let me just pick up a few of the loose ends that I've heard here. The senator from Nenana says, if you do it my way, you're not ducking the issues, but if you do it Joe's way, you are. You know, it doesn't work that way. It's just as much to be straightforward as to vote for the substitute as to vote for his proposition. Then we get this allegation of legalese. I think the substitute has much less legalese than the original proposition. Again, if we declare that we have substantial but less than clear and convincing evidence of an impeachable offense, what is the consensus, I haven't heard it, as to how much evidence that is? Is it a 20% case? Is it a 30% case? Is it a probability? Is it a 40% case? We know it's less than clear and convincing evidence, but remember that pencil that we started off with about reasonable doubt and preponderance. Where in that does this legalese fit? And what are we saying to the people of Alaska? I will be very frank with you, Mr. President. I am not sure. I am not conscientiously sure whether any of the witnesses and all their remarks were candid and truthful. But I am not going to vote to tar someone's name forever. Someone who has lived in Alaska and who will live in Alaska for decades to come on the basis of the fact that it is cognitively impossible for me or you, any of you, to know what was in the human heart. And let me point out that the majority report says that. The majority report, in expressly that language, says that you cannot look into the human heart. If you cannot look into the human heart and you say you can't, then how do you vote for this resolution? Yes, the governor went to a press conference, and I again commend Senator Kelly. I think he did the fairest possible job. But recall that the governor asked to appear before Mr. Hickey and Mr. Gorsuch, and the chair ruled that he could not do that, and so the governor took his case to the public, which he certainly had a right to do. I'll close by just saying something about the chief counsel. I do have to depart from some of my friends here in terms of the characterization of his work. I have no quibble or quarrel with the chief counsel. I think if he had not asked the hard questions, if I had not asked the hard questions, if the other members of the Senate had not asked the hard questions, we would know far less about this matter than we know. But remember that Mr. Dash, in those words that Senator Coghill read, began by saying that we are the judges of the truth, and it has to be that way. We are the Alaskans. We know Governor Sheffield, and we saw him tested not only in office but as a candidate and as a business person. Mr. Dash does not have that background. We are the judges. We are the people who are responsible to the constituency, not Mr. Dash. And in fact, that is really why Mr. Dash was brought here, because we wanted the advice of someone who had a different perspective from ours. And it has been an enriching perspective, but it doesn't mean that we have to abdicate our own role as the judges in the matter. We can't abdicate our own role. And when he made those recommendations or those comments about where the sufficiency of evidence might lie that we were the judges, he was talking to us in a context where the issue was impeachment. I do not read those comments as a statement that if we judge that there should be no impeachment, which is what we have judged, that we should run out on the street and call Mr. Sheffield, now by implication and on Saturday expressly, a liar. I think we should not do that, and we should adopt the substitute.
Senator Boone.
Thank you, Mr. President. I was going to stay seated until I received a POM from one of my constituents in Spinard. But I'm going to preface it by saying that never have I been torn in so many different directions than I have with these hearings. I've given more attention to it. I've read more. I've agonized more than any other thing that I've done that I can think of in my life. So what I aim to say is that I hope that my colleagues will take me seriously. I can't say that some are not my very good and close friends because there isn't convincing evidence that they are. But I'd like to just quote from this particular POM. I don't mind saying it comes from a Marie Harms, which I don't know, in Spinard. In her last sentence reads, without the passage of, we're talking of Senator Coghill's resolution, you will have forever stamped approval on corruption and a recommendation to use, I don't recall, as a future successful defense for prosecution for wrongdoings. I think that kind of sums it up. By not doing this, by not passing the resolution, we are showing our approval of complete innocence of this administration. And we would not have all of the things that are going to come before the courts if there wasn't something haywire someplace. And that's food for thought. Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. President, I don't want to discuss impeachment offense, and I don't want to discuss the governor's candidates. What I want to know from the maker of this amendment is why the supporters of this amendment are taking out of the language from the resolution to be voted on in the Senate, further resolve that the Senate finds significant irregularities in the leasing process surrounding the Fifth Avenue Center in Fairbanks. We have sat here for 3 weeks and heard about significant irregularity from the top on down. Now, why is that language coming out of the resolution?
Mr. President,
I'm pleased that the Senator from Eagle River asked that question because I forgot one point. Senator Todd Hill spoke on behalf of the original document, and unlike Mr. Alcovar, I have to refer to a note. About the activities of the people who work for the governor. And you know, that is not an impeachable matter. I think Mr. Dash has counseled us, I know he's counseled me privately, that we are talking in impeachment terms about malfeasance and misfeasance. We are not talking about the actions of subordinates which are imputed to a governor or boss on the basis of a master-servant relationship. And the fact that there may or may not have been irregularities carried out by others in the government is not germane to the issue of impeachment. Now, I would say to the Senator from Eagle River that those issues may be germane, and I think will be germane, in a future election. And I have no problem with somebody. Should Governor Sheffield stand for election, or the Lieutenant Governor stand for election, making arguments about that. And the governor and his allies will say that there were not irregularities or that the lease was in the public interest. I think that is what this country is all about. But I don't think it was germane to the issue of what this special session is all about.
Senator Victor Fisher?
Mr. President, several of my colleagues have cried crocodile tears over removal of several sections of the Coghill resolution through the substitute resolution. The same senators had no problem removing a number of factual statements from the resolution we were discussing this morning, statements of which I was very proud that I thought very accurately, very factually reflected certain concerns, certain realities. Let me say that I think that we have a very clear choice right now in voting on the substitute resolution. If you believe per the Coghill resolution that the Senate finds substantial evidence that William J. Sheffield has committed an impeachable offense, then you vote no. Again, you find substantial evidence that he has committed an impeachable offense, you vote no. If you want to state that the Senate finds, that the Senate does not find clear and convincing evidence that William J. Sheffield has committed an impeachable offense, you vote yes. I suggest we vote yes.
Senator Ricardo.
Mr. President, I'm surprised that my good friend and colleague from downtown Anchorage was pulling a lawyer tactic on me, and that is that you read my resolution, or the Rules Committee resolution, saying that be it resolved that the Senate, after lengthy testimony, finds substantial evidence that William J. Sheffield had committed an impeachable offense. That's not correct and accurate. The Rules testimony find substantial, but less than clear and convincing evidence. And that was the standard that, the Rules Committee put on the rules. So I think that we have to make the record very clear, but that find substantial is taken out of the substitute of Senator Josephson's, and then we're taking out the two revolves. Further revolve that the Senate seriously questioned the accuracy of William J. Sheffield's testimony under oath. I think the record shows that. Further resolve that the Senate finds significant irregularities in the leasing process surrounding the Fifth Avenue Center of Burbank. And there, Mr. President, I was referring to my very statement that, the Senator from Anchorage, Senator Josephson, was attacking, and that is the fact is that, the guy that sits in the corner pocket can't pass the buck. And the Constitution of the State of Alaska was so designed. And he's responsible for the executive branch, and more particularly for those that work in the governor's office.
Mr. President, just a procedural question here. Under the title, I mean, is there any problem with the title as dealing with more than one subject? I wonder. This plain resolution, I don't know if that bothers you or not. I haven't got my Mason's manual. I have a third one.
Any further discussion?
Question.
The question being, shall amendment number one be adopted? Senators will proceed to vote. Has any senator failed to vote? Secretary will lock the roll. Does any senator wish to change his or her vote? The Secretary will record the vote.
The roll shows 11 yeas and 9 nays.
So amendment number one has been adopted.
I have no other amendments.
Is there any further discussion? Ready for the question? Senator Hoffman?
Mr. President, at this point, the resolution reflects, I believe, a standard of conduct and a standard of truth that doesn't reflect where the people think the elected public official should be, and I feel I oppose the resolution for that reason.
The question being, shall Senate Resolution Number 7 pass the Senate? Senators may proceed to vote. Has any senator failed to vote? Secretary will lock the roll. Does any senator wish to change his or her vote? Secretary, record the vote.
The roll shows 12 yeas, 8 nays.
And so Senate Resolution Number 7 has passed the Senate. Is there any unfinished business? At this time, I would like to inform the body that Senator Ferguson has notified me that due to scheduling conflicts during their interim, he is unable to continue to serve as a member of the Joint Special Committee on Legislative Salaries. I am therefore appointing Senator Fahrenkamp to replace Senator Ferguson on the interim committee. Also, the appointment to the just passed Senate Resolution Number 6, Senator Fakes will be chairman, Senator Bertula will be vice chairman, Senator Joe Josephson, Senator Halford, Senator DeVries, and Senator Zaroff. The announcement of committee meetings. Are there any special orders? Senator Kellogg?
Mr. President, I request the floor to express appreciation.
Senator Kellogg?
Mr. President, the last 3 weeks have been somewhat hectic. They've been late nights and early mornings, and I'd like to express the Rules Committee appreciation to our Senate floor staff, in particular the Sergeant of Arms, Jack Gibbons, the Assistant Sergeant of Arms, John Alcantara, and the pages, Robin Gray, Alan Plotnick, Susan Rhodes, and Betsy Shanker. Thank you very much.
Senator Ferguson.
I move and ask unanimous consent that my floor statement on the Saturday, August 3rd, Rules Committee meeting be entered in the record.
Great. No objection. Senator Victor Fisher?
I would like to have a privilege of the floor to also express appreciation.
Hearing no objections?
Mr. President, I would like to express my personal appreciation, I'm sure that of many others, for the fair and objective manner in which the Chair of the Rules Committee and the President have conducted this whole proceeding. It's been very difficult at times. I've been highly critical at times. I must say that all in all, I commend you. I find this to be a very fine experience, and I hope that we will see the same kind of leadership during the regular session beginning January. Thank you.
Bill Joseph.
I certainly echo that, and I think I mentioned Senator Kelly's role Saturday. I also want to mention your own role, Mr. President, because you had a great burden to bear, and I think you've done a magnificent job. I'm advised that Governor Sheffield has an invitation to all members of the Senate and all members of the press to his office for coffee and cookies, regardless of your vote on this question. And I hope as many senators as possible will say hello to the governor before you leave town. Thank you.
Turn direct.
Mr. President, I would just like to express my respect and admiration to all the members of the whole body, and I would just as soon respect and admire them from a distance.
Senator Halford.
Mr. President, did you want a motion to adjourn, or do you want to wait until the House comes back in? How do you want to handle that?
Just a simple motion to adjourn.
A motion to adjourn. This won't adjourn the joint session, but the joint session will be constitutionally adjourned, so the House doesn't have to come back in and officially adjourn.
Correct.
Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent the Senate stand in adjournment.
Senate adjourned.